On this episode of the Real Life Carry podcast, myself and Zabo interview what could possibly be the podcast's highest profile guest thus far. We spent some time talking to former major winner Rich Beem. Rich currently works for Sky Sports as an expert golf analyst. However, he can also boast of having had a very successful career on the PGA Tour. Rich talks to us about the early days of his golf career, the transition to becoming a professional golfer, and all of the highs and lows of the game. Most people would think that winning a golf major would be the highlight of a golfer's career. However, Rich tells us about what he believes was his best golfing achievement. We ask him about current life at Sky Sports and what the future holds for his golf. We really could have spent hours chatting, as he's got so much insight into the game and knowledge to share. If you have any questions, opinions or comments, please send them in on social media or via email, podcast@glorifieddonkey.com. If you're a new listener, check out previous episodes of the podcast and please do share the show with others. In the meantime though, it's a great episode that I know you will enjoy. Okay, so we're here with Zabo.
Good to be here.
And Rich Beem. Welcome.
Hi.
Rich.
Howdy.
I know you've been calling me for a long time and wanting to be on to the Real Life Carry podcast. And, you know, I'm sorry that it's taken so long, but you're on now. This is your
been
stage.
Begging you. You know, I mean, it was just, it just got to the point where I really felt like you didn't love me anymore. You know, you're blanking me.
It's a tough ticket to crack to get on the Real Life Caddy podcast.
I know, apparently so.
Well, in all fairness, you're only the second professional golfer to ever come on this podcast.
That's well, true. Listen, I've always felt like I'm a good number two.
Okay, we're gonna, for people that don't know who you are, please tell us who you are.
Former cell phone and car stereo salesman at Magnolia Hi-Fi, then worked at El Paso Country Club for a few years, played golf for a couple of years, and then now I work for Sky Sports as an analyst.
In between, you won a few golf tournaments. What was the peak?
Well, I mean, yeah, the Hilton Open in Socorro, New Mexico was a big one. There's no doubt. I won the match play, Sun Country Section match play. Back in 1998 is awesome. Yeah.
And I'm going to tell people the 2002 PGA Championship.
Oh, that thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Who was runner up in that tournament? Who was runner up in that tournament?
The rest of the field.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Rich, take us back to the start. Okay. When did you start playing golf?
My dad was a club pro, was golf professional. Actually, he was a first team All American back in 1963, I believe, in Mexico State University. And back in the day, there was no money in golf, really. So dad got into the golf business. And so I'm just basically the product of a guy that's been a geek about the game for a long time. And so I've been around the game of golf since I was born because of dad, and I have not really known anything else in this world. Like I said, I tried to sell cell phones and car stereos for about 9 months, but that really didn't work out.
When did you pick up your first club?
I think I had some photos when I was about 3 years old, but you know, it's just, I mean, it probably was before that, but, yeah, I mean, I've been around this game my entire life.
And your dad was he was a golf pro, but wasn't he a golf pro at some like military course? Didn't you travel around? You were in other countries when you were young, right?
Yeah, so dad worked. Started off in New Mexico, and then we went from New Mexico down to Panama, then Panama to Berlin, Germany, and then Berlin back to New Mexico. But yeah, I lived overseas for about 7 years, just because my dad, that nature of his job.
Yeah, sprechen Sie Deutsch?
Not a lick.
Zwei Bier bitte.
Yeah, well, I can, you know, two more would be nice too.
Ah, nice one. Okay, so you were born and brought up in Phoenix, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah. When did you reach scratch? How old were you?
I don't think I was a scratch golfer until sometime in college.
Really? Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't break. Hell, I didn't break. I was telling the story earlier today. I didn't shoot in the 60s until I was a sophomore in college.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you went to the University of New Mexico, correct?
Oh, my God. Did you not do any research? I mean,
no, I'm like Joe Rogan. I don't do any research.
You know, funny enough, he didn't do any, but I actually just finished Bud, Sweat, and Tease right before this interview. So I'm well versed.
Oh, yeah. That'll tell you exactly nothing about me.
Tells a lot about Steve, though.
New Mexico State University. Come on.
Listen, I'm from the UK. What's the difference?
It's all the same.
Oh, you know what? So you're English.
No, I'm Scottish. You know, it's part of the UK.
English. It's the same thing.
Same thing. Exactly.
Same accent.
Thank you very much.
Hey, agreed.
Touche. So you go through high school. Were you a good player in high school?
Yeah, I played in high school. Played in Germany when I was over there. Was 1 year in New Mexico. But yeah, I was. I was late bloomer. Very, very late bloomer. Played 1 year. Basically in Las Cruces, that's it. Las Cruces High, baby.
Go and Bulldogs. Kind of a unique story, right? Because you never went through like the Nike tour or anything. You just went to Q school, got your card, and you won shortly thereafter in your rookie season. I mean, you know, why crazy.
Why waste any time with the other shit, right? Let's just go right to what we want to do. And let's play golf on the biggest tour in the world. Why go through all the mundane small mini tours and all that other BS? Why not just get out there and just go straight forward right to the PGA Tour?
Yeah, you're going to be a bear, be a grizzly.
Yeah. Did you grow up wanting to be a pro?
You know what? I'm going to borrow that on TV this week. You're going to be a bear, be a grizzly. You know what? I like that. That's manly.
That's Josh Fisher's special, but yeah.
When you grew up, what point did you say, I want to be a pro golfer?
Never. I mean, I think when I was a kid, I just loved the game, loved being around it. I played it for fun and never really played it for any other reason to, you know, other than, you know, funny enough, I didn't play it in a region than to gamble. I loved the action. You know, I gambled all the time as a kid, you know, didn't have a lot of junior golfers in Panama or Berlin. So I basically, when I went out to go play, I'd play with the men, and I grew up around gambling, understood all the games when I was a kid. But, I think that, you know, something to be said for that. So, I not once did I ever think or ever believe that I was going to grow up and be a professional golfer. I mean, professional gambler, possibly, but never a professional golfer.
And then you turn pro and tell us about that.
Oh, that was just me sitting around with a, 12 pack of beer with my buddies and decided that, I'm going to be a pro. So I turned pro like on a Saturday night, after playing golf one day. I was actually going to go get a job, but I took a job up at, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, as an assistant pro. And that's when I kind of quote unquote officially became a pro. But no, I mean, I knew that at some point in time I was going to do something in the game of golf. I don't know what it was or how I was going to get there, but I figured golf was always going to be in my future somehow. But I just didn't know in what capacity. I never expected to be a player, to be fair. I figured I'd probably just be a club pro at some point in time, kind of follow my dad's footsteps.
What's your best score ever?
60. Shot 60. Funny enough, and it was a tournament, albeit it was at Spanish Oaks in Austin, Texas. So I want to say about 2004, 2005. And it was supposed to be a 2-day event. It was supposed to be a member, and I was new to the area. And so I just wanted to go play and meet a couple of guys. And the first day on Friday got rained out. And so it went from a 2-day event to a 1-day event, best ball. And I shot 60 and I had 3 eagles, one of them being a hole in one. And the putt I had in the last hole for 59 came up a couple inches short from about 40 feet, albeit. But one of the guys that I played with that day still gives me grief every single day about it.
Wow. So you said best ball. What was your team score if you shot 60?
60.
That's pretty good. How many hole-in-ones do you have in your life? We always ask people this.
A baker's dozen. 13.
Wow. Ever wear white pants on the golf course?
Oh God. Well, you know what? I did. I started taking it up last year for whatever ungodly.
Last year?
I know.
Trying to bring it back.
Listen, when you get old, you really don't care about fashion anymore. You just, you know, it's kind of, it was hot. I thought, you know what? Just white pants and whatnot. But yeah, I wore white pants. No white belts though. Don't do the white belts, but do the white pants.
Okay. That's, I don't know. Both are no-nos for me.
Really? It's because you're gross. You're big and gross.
True. Yeah. There are rules in white pants, female body, you know, slim hips.
Yeah.
Weigh 165.
Well, I mean, not a good day. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, you can't pull, you know, most anything off except for, you know, darks.
Very okay. True. I'm not going to argue with that.
I know. Well, you can't. I mean,
you're spot on. You're spot on there. tell us what was the best thing about being a pro?
Oh, like Christmas every day. You walk in the driving range and, you know, if you liked it, you know, oh yeah, we'd love to send you some of that. So if it, you know, the motto on tour is if it's free, give me three. Uh-huh. It's like Christmas every single day out on the PGA Tour. I mean, if, you know, people are just manufacturers just there to help you out and give you stuff and this and that. There are guys that abuse it. There's no doubt. And I never got to that point. At least I don't think I did anyways, but you know, anything that you wanted, that was the latest and greatest, or if you needed to know something or you had any questions, you had basically the best in the world, the experts of the world when it came to club manufacturing, they were right there at your fingertips. And that was probably the coolest thing about it. It's like having the best club fitters in the world right there 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of it was phenomenal, but in the same breath though, that's also the worst thing that could ever happen, because you have so many guys out there that if you start questioning yourself and you always think there's something a little bit better out there, something that can help you out and whatnot. I was always a tinker. So unfortunately I spent a lot more time in the vans, but I love the vans, man. I you know, getting out there and hanging out and seeing all the cool stuff, asking questions, but it certainly probably hindered my game more than helped.
Mm-hmm. Were you just natural ability or were you a hard worker?
Natural, more natural than anything else. I think that, you know, going back to the gambling concept, you know, I think that I just, when I got out there to play, I just would rather go play for money, whether I had it or not. So when you're out there, even as a kid playing for money, I was never thinking about my swing. I was always thinking about how to get in the hole as quick as I could. Dad was a great coach, great teacher, and he really shaped my swing from a young age. But, you know, what he also instilled in me is, here, go figure it out. You know, here's a sand wedge, here's a lob wedge. Go figure out how to chip it up and down from all these different angles and whatnot. And there's, you know, didn't really teach a whole lot of technique other than showing me a few things. But it was just more like, figure it out and but have fun figuring it out too.
Did you watch a lot of golf as a kid? Did you emulate golfers on tour? Did you follow many golfers on tour? Did you have people you look up to? Or
not really. Not until I was a little bit older. I think that because my dad liked Nicklaus so much that, you know, I was always a Jack Nicklaus fan. Then when I got, you know, into college, I think like everybody else on the planet, Fred Couples would be a guy that I loved to watch. But no, I you know, I can't say that I had too many guys that I love to watch or I even emulated, because I think that everybody out there has got such a unique swing, or used to, until, you know, video came into play and people would really analyze and break down swings and things like that. But no, I never emulated anybody. My dad gave me basically one swing tip when I was a young kid. He says, keep your elbows as close together during the swing and not much can go wrong. And that's the one thing that I've always, it's always stuck with me.
Do you think golf today is overanalyzed?
Oh, 1,000,000%. Absolutely. I think that we break down and I mean, it's hard not to, especially in my work, my line of work right now, working for Sky Sports. I mean, you're always asked to break down players, and analyze what went right, what went wrong. And I think at the end of the day, you know, what we sometimes forget is that golf is just a difficult game that you can see the physical aspect of it, but you can't see the mental aspect of it. And mental aspect of it, as we all know, is 90% of the problem. So I think the golf swing and the golf is absolutely overanalyzed, and people break down stats. They break down the golf swing. They dissect everything to the nth degree. And yet, funny enough, that little white golf ball is affected by basically one thing, and that's Mother Nature. Once it leaves your club face, it's gone. Mother Nature is going to take care of the rest. Where, you know, you could land it right in the middle of the fairway and it could hit in the side of a divot and kick dead left in the water, or it could miss that divot by a fraction and go scampering down the fairway in a perfect space. I mean, it's just, you never know. Once that golf ball leaves club face, you got 0.0 control over it for the rest of its journey.
Do you think that that overanalysis obviously has a detrimental effect on amateur golf?
In some respects, yes. But I think that you know, the analysis part of it sometimes helps the amateurs in the simple fact that they can actually maybe understand a little bit more about their game. I think that when the amateurs break it down too much, depending on their level of, you know, their ability, then yeah. I think what the overanalysis does, anything else, is it slows the game down. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, even if you look at it, when pros, and this, then they're the culprits of this, but, you know, it started with the greens books. Everybody talking about the greens books slowing things down. I'm not too sure I believe that. I think it didn't help the situation. Here's what slows down the game more than anything else is the line on the golf ball.
We just talked about this.
On the golf ball. You sit there. I mean, you guys work out at Pebble Beach as caddies, and when you sit there and see an amateur put the line down on the golf ball and try and line it up, and it's, I mean, not only is the line crooked, but it's also, it's not even close to their line, but they're emulating what they see on TV, right? Now, here's the funny thing. When you look at the pros on TV and you look at when they hit their putts, how many times is that line going end over end exactly how they line it up?
Not often.
Almost never, no. Right? And I understand why they do it, right? It gives them a visual. It kind of helps them out. But the time that they take lining it up, you know, with the putter right here and this and that, and trying to be so precise and so perfect, now that adds how much time to the game, right? I mean, I truly believe, you know what, if you really want to make the pros accountable, don't have them have some of the markings on the golf ball. Just say, listen, give them a blank golf ball, and you got to put your own dots on it. You know, everybody knows it's going to be a Titleist or a Callaway or this and that. Put your own marks on it, this and that, or have just some sort of marking on it instead of all the stampings on it. That way you don't have the line on the golf ball, all right, because that's part of the deal. You still, you know, that's part of the challenge of it. You have to line it up. And, you know, you put that line down there, and then you add another big line or the triple track. And I'm, no offense, Callaway. I love you, Callaway. But, you know, you add that element where you, isn't that part of the difficulty of playing this game is lining it up? I mean, why can't you line it up with your, you know, something with your feet now and all this? I mean, I just think it adds so much time to the game, those lines.
Back to you as a player, because it is mostly about that. We'll get on to different things. When you were a tour player on the PGA Tour, how many tournaments did you play a year?
I played a bunch. I just love playing.
Are we talking 35 to 40 tournaments a year?
No. But it was easily 30. You know, it was about 30 events a year on tour. I'm trying to remember back how many, because we did have some more. There was a bit more time off when I first got on tour in 1999. But I probably averaged close to 30 events a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just enjoyed it. I, you know, there's also, you know, the element of, you know, I the travel aspect of it, but going to each city and and meeting up with friends and playing golf at courses I enjoyed. It was just in my DNA. I just loved to go to different places and play.
Each week, would you go to a tournament and work in something, or would you have a set structure, or was it just roll the dice?
No, I mean, I was probably one of those guys that you know, I would look at what happened last week and figure out what wasn't working, what did I need to work on a little bit, did I need to make any equipment changes, which was all, you know, way too often in my mind's eye, but you know, looking back on it, but you know, I was kind of one of those players that you kind of take it as it comes. I think that I was never very structured as far as, you know, the only thing I was structured about is I would always wake up early, go get my practice rounds in early on Tuesdays when I wasn't playing in the pro-am on Wednesday, because I didn't want to tee off at 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning with every other player out there and it taking 5.5 hours. I never believed that you should be out there on the golf course in your practice round taking that much time. You can do all of it, and instead of going to the sides of every green and chipping incessantly and putting from every angle known to man, you can just go look at it and take some notes and get a visual of it instead of actually sitting there and chipping from every spot or putting from every spot. I just didn't like that. So I didn't want to sit there and wait for three other guys to go through all of that while I was already on the next tee box just twiddling my thumbs because the group in front of me was sitting around the green or around the green or in the fairway hitting multiple shots. I wanted my pro-am, my practice rounds to be just that, rounds of golf, not practice sessions.
That makes sense. Were there certain events through the course of the year that you would look forward to more than the others? And like, did they have, they have better food at some events, like better player hospitality, stuff like that?
You know, Chicago is always a must, and it had a lot to do with the town and, you know, going to dinner downtown Chicago, certain restaurants, things like that. The golf course was, you know, always good at Cog Hill, but it wasn't great, to be fair. The International, Castle Pines was a must. There was always a good handful of tournaments that were always a must that you needed to go play in for different reasons. And I think as I got older, it had to do a lot more with friends, in certain areas, family in certain areas. But, you know, I think that, you know, more than everything else, there was probably a handful of events you never wanted to miss. And most of them had to do with the golf course, but not all the time.
Yeah. I mean, there had to be certain courses where, you know, horses for courses, places that you played well, that you knew were good money-making opportunities for you every year, right? Because you knew you played those courses well.
You would think, yeah. You know, as much as I loved L.A., it was either feast or famine at Riv for me. You know, I loved Riv. One of my favorite places to go and stay. It still is as a commentator. But, you know, there were some times, though, where you'd get the first tee time out of the morning at Riv was off of either number one or 10 was also, you know, was also very stressful because, you know, if you tee off at Riv at, say, 6:50 in the morning on Thursday and you didn't birdie number one, I can't tell you how bad of a – you just got down in the mouth about it because now you knew you had to turn right back around and go to the hardest hole in the golf course usually, which is number two, and you already feel like you made bogey on the first hole because you didn't make birdie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you make a five, but you always feel like, you know what, if you make four and five on the first two holes, you're fine. But if you go 5-4, it doesn't feel the same. It's like you're happy going birdie bogey, but if you go par-par, you just don't feel good about it. It's the strangest thing in the world, right? But, you know, Riv was always kind of one of those feast and famine kind of places for me. There's a couple other places that I probably did okay, but I was equally good and equally crappy at a lot of golf courses. Yeah.
What's your favorite golf course you've ever played?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Or how about this? Give us top three. How about that? Because it's tough to go best ever.
Yeah, it's always tough to go number. Yeah, so top three. Number one was on tour was always Riv. But I think that the top courses I've ever played, one of them would have been in Morocco.
Oh, yeah? Wow.
And Agadir, Morocco. And it was, to be fair, I don't know the actual name of it, but it was the King's Course in Agadir, and it literally was his backyard.
It was the King of Morocco's golf course.
He had three golf courses down there. He commissioned Robert Trent Jones to come over there and build three of them. And I played one of them. And the funny thing is that I'd heard stories about how guys would go back there and the pins would be in the same exact spot on Sunday as when they showed up the following year on Monday for a practice round. They didn't change. Nobody played the golf course. I went down there and walked it on Monday afternoon. And I'd never seen a more magnificent golf course without a single divot out of the fairways.
Wow.
I mean, it was unbelievable.
It's good to be the king.
The European Tour actually play there now.
Do they really?
Well, they did. They move it around. They move it to different. But are they going back to Agadir this year?
No, this is back 2010. So they returned. Golf Royale.
That's Agadir. I played in that one. That's the course.
Wow. Okay. So that's one of them. Give us another couple.
We got Riv. We got
Riviera, Agadir, in Morocco.
Riv is just kind of on tour. There's a golf course I was a member at for a little while up in Idaho, Northern Idaho, called the Club of Black Rock. And I love the Club of Black Rock. And again, it's just more about, the way I judge golf courses and favorite ones is just, can I go there and relax and have fun and just be myself? And that was definitely a place I can go and relax me. And the other one would be Butler National in Chicago. I used to go to, Chicago is always one of my stops on tour that I would go to, and I just loved it. But I mean, listen, I could go on and on about all the great places that I've played around the world, but some of the favorites are, most of my favorites have really, part of it has to do with the golf course, but part of it has to do with how much fun do you have going and actually playing the golf course? How welcome do you feel? What's the vibe like? And this is not a knock on Augusta National, because I know that's on everybody's bucket list, but I go to Augusta National every year, and it's wonderful. It's the most magnificent spot on the planet, from a beauty point. But I always felt like, you just didn't want to piss anybody off there. And listen, I used to get spanked every single day by my mom, even though she didn't catch me doing anything. She goes, I know you did something bad today, so I'm going to spank you. So, I mean, I messed up every single day. So when you walk around the hallowed grounds of Augusta National and all that, I know that I'm going to screw up at some point in time, which I have, but it's just like, oh my gosh, I just can't handle the pressure.
Now, we have to go, the highlight of your career, obviously, was 2002, correct?
Or was it not?
It might have been, you tell me.
Well, I think that's the one that sticks out most of in everybody's mind. I think the one stub that I ever kept on top, the scorecards that you kept was final round of Q School back in 1998 when I shot 66 the final round. I hit it 33 times and I putted it 33 times.
Wow. Nice. Okay.
That's probably the best round of golf I've ever played under the circumstances, to go from making $13,000 a year as an assistant pro to now playing for, millions of dollars each week on the, PGA Tour. So, I think that is probably something that I'm most proud of, to even have a shot to win the PGA or even to get on tour. But I think that, the PGA Championship, obviously, with everything that it's provided me with my life, it's definitely the most significant victory.
Okay. Do you think there's too much emphasis put on major titles?
No, I don't.
Okay. So you think that's the echelon of the...
I do. I think I think that if you ask every golfer out there, they're playing for titles. And hear me out on this, because it's not that every player, and I certainly wasn't one of them, but I mean, it's not that every player is ever going to have an opportunity to win a major. And, you know, look at Ryan Brehm last week and what he did in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
He went out and he had to win the tournament in order to keep his tour card. He had, I mean, that was it.
Unbelievable.
It was do or die. This is it. You got 0.0 chances after this. And he went out and won by 6. In a lot of ways, to me, that is more impressive than me winning the PGA at Hazeltine because of the circumstances that surrounded it, right? So I think that everybody has to look at majors differently. And I think that if you're going to be a player like Colin Montgomery, who had an unbelievable career, what was it, 8 order of merits?
8, yeah. 7 in a row and then 1 at the end.
7 in a row, 8 order of merits, but never won a major. And I can promise you he'd give up every single one of those order of merits to have 1 major. Sergio Garcia was kind of in the same boat until he won the Masters playoff over Justin Rose. And all of a sudden, now his career is complete. I think that with certain players that, yes, majors are all of it. And I think that if you win a major, then it does put you in a different league, even if you're Sean McKeel, and that's the only win that you've ever had in your life, right? Listen, it shouldn't take away from the fact that he only won 1 event, and it was the major that he won, the PGA at Oak Hill. It's interesting how people sometimes look at that and be like, well, that's, you know, that was a fluke. Well, I watched every other player in that field have the same opportunity that he did to excel at that golf course, and not a single one of them could step up to the plate and do it. So why do you take anything away from what he did over those 4 days? I think that if you win a major, you should be commended for it because you beat probably the best field, especially the PGA Championship. And I'll hang my hat on this 8 days a week because it is the hardest one to win strength of field wise. There is nothing, there's no stronger field in the game of golf than the PGA Championship. The Masters, you have past champions that may not be on top of their game, and you only have usually maybe 90 to 100 of them. The U.S. Open and an Open Championship, amateurs qualify, anybody can qualify. But the PGA Championship, historically, you know, when I won, 98 out of the top 100 were there, and now you're getting closer to 100 out of the top 100 show up. Mm-hmm. And you don't have that at any other major. And I know that we also have club pros and at the PGA Championship and guys like me, past champions that play, but it historically is the hardest one to win strength of field wise.
How did you feel like leading up to that PGA? Did you have a feeling before going to Hazeltine that you had a chance to maybe, I mean, win a major like that? Like did he have certain practice that like, oh, something clicked and it's like, okay, I'm going to go out here and shoot some good rounds.
Yeah. Tell us about the lead up to that 2002 PGA Championship.
Well, I won 2 weeks prior at the International, which was a massive victory. And I just showed up there kind of like I'd do any other event. You know, you guys asked preparation wise, you know, what did I do going into it? 0.0. I went there with the same attitude and same everything I took there, went out, saw the golf course, found that I liked it, I felt like I understood it right away. It was a good driving golf course for me. I felt like I found some pretty good driving lines off the tee boxes, and I felt really good with the putter all week long. And it was one of those things where I felt at ease with the golf course. And I think that's something that's really hard to find when you go to majors, is to find something about that golf course that you really like, you really enjoy, And for whatever reason, right off the get-go, there was just something that was pretty straightforward to me about Hazeltine. And it's funny because I go back there now and I look at the golf course and go, God bless, this thing is the hardest place I've ever freaking seen, man. And yet when I was there, I was playing so well that it just, everything kind of fell into place. And I didn't overanalyze it. I didn't think it. I didn't spend too much time, you know, practicing or playing it. Played two practice rounds there, went out on Wednesday, and we maybe spent an hour, hitting balls. And I'm like, I don't even know what to do. And my caddy Bill goes, yeah, you know what? I don't see anything. I don't see any reason why we're still here. Let's get out of here. So we did. We took off and we spent like literally Wednesday, an hour out there from like 9 to 10 and then took off.
And like during the week, the nerves never, like Saturday, Sunday, when you realize, you know, I could win this thing. You're looking at, I mean, the guy right behind you, Tiger Woods, winning the first two majors of the year. Are you thinking like, oh my God, I'm up here with Tiger Woods playing his best golf? I mean,
it's interesting because people ask me all the time about Tiger and whatnot. And I stick to my guns every single time. I never thought about him one iota. And it's no disrespect, and it's, you know, because he is that good, and you realize that he's there, but you also realize that, you know, as a player, you have a job to do. Your job is to go out there and win the tournament. It was funny because we were on the driving range on Sunday. I was walking over to Chipping Green, and he was walking back with he and Stevie and Butch. I walked by him, and in Rich Beam fashion, I just go, you know, good luck, guys. You know, good luck, Tiger. Have fun today. You know? Yes. And he's looking at me like,
who the hell are you?
Who is this idiot? Yeah. Right? I mean, who the hell, you know, says good? I mean, and he didn't say a single word and whatnot.
That's awesome. But
I mean, I said, hey, you know, good luck today. Have fun. You know, enjoy it. And yet that's just who I was and mm-hmm. you know, who that's I still
awesome.
Am.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But, you know, I think that, you know, you recognize that he's there, but it's hard enough to win a golf tournament and think about the pressures that it takes to do that. If you're thinking about him as well, you got less than 0.0 chance of winning. I just think that I never got wrapped up into what he was doing because I couldn't control a single thing. I was trying not to, you know, vomit on myself, much less
shut your white pants.
Trying to think about him. I wore khaki pants that day.
Khakis.
And some khakis. And then some brand new white FootJoy Classics. Ooh. Thank you very much.
Okay, so you win that tournament, and then what happens after that? Is all of a sudden, does the phone start going?
Oh, God. Well,
thankfully, social media didn't exist back in the day.
How did you celebrate? Like Shane Lowry?
Yeah, that would have been bad because I would have gone viral probably in more ways than I shouldn't have. No, you know what? It was interesting. You know, there's a ton of stories. We'll get a chance to tell them next time about the aftermath of it all, which will really be funny. But, you know, we went straight on to Seattle that night, got to the hotel about midnight or so, walked in the bar. The CBS guys were there. I bought them all drinks. I asked to be upgraded to a suite if I could be, and they had nothing available except for a handicap suite. I said, I'll take it. It doesn't matter.
Give me what I can get.
It probably worked, actually. It wasn't that much bigger and just had a walk-in shower instead of a bathtub in it, you know? So it's just like, okay, that's fine. But, you know, yeah, I mean, the phone definitely was ringing off the hook, this and that. But thankfully, you know, cell phones weren't what they are now. They weren't that way back then. You didn't have the apps. You didn't have, you know, any of the messaging. If you want to talk to somebody, you had to call them. You know, it still wasn't, you know, there's no text messaging and things like that. So it was, you know, thankfully it was a little bit quieter back then, but so I could still kind of go and disappear and be myself. But, you know, we finally, quote unquote, fell asleep around 4 a.m. My wife, my caddy and I, and then I woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning just cause you can't sleep. I mean, you're just looking up at the ceiling laughing, you know, you turn on SportsCenter and you're everywhere. You're giggling, you're just giggling about it all. But yeah, it was just afterwards. It was the next week was kind of a blur. I mean, I think I finished fifth the next week up in Seattle. I have no idea how it happened, but I couldn't wait to get out of Seattle and get back home.
Yeah. Did the phone start ringing as well for commercials or changing clubs or sponsorship?
A little bit of sponsorship. It wasn't really changing sponsorship. You know, Ashworth signed a contract with them. They actually flew somebody up to offer me a deal, which is great. You know, the one thing that I turned down, and it bums me out to this day, is that I was asked to go on the David Letterman show. Oh. But we were over on the West Coast, and I had to fly back to the East Coast. And, I mean, getting back and forth was, I mean, I was already spent. And it was just, it didn't make sense at the time, because I'm like, man, if I got to go back there on Tuesday, I just got there on Sunday night, I'd fly back for a Tuesday taping midday and then fly back Tuesday afternoon. I'm thinking, man, I mean, that is just, I mean, that's 9 hours in the air and this and that. I mean, that's another 12 hours out of my day, and I'm already spent. And I just, my wife's parents and friends came up to Seattle from Idaho. I had one of my best friends, best man at my wedding, lives in Seattle. And I was just like, man, I don't want to do that. And looking back at now, and I go, you're such a dumbass. I mean, David Letterman, I mean, come on, man. I mean, David Letterman. But that's the only thing that I regret about doing it. But I mean, I remember waking up at, this is actually a really funny story. So I remember waking up on, I think it was like Wednesday morning, bright and earlier, and I was on the Today Show, unfortunately live. And it was about 5 a.m. my time, 8 a.m. their time. And so Matt Lauer was interviewing me.
Oh, yeah.
This was before all this.
A good Matt
before
Lauer.
Before all the Dirty Bird stuff came
did,
out.
Did
yeah.
he let Did he let you into the office with the little button he had, or did he lock you in, actually?
That's for me to know. I need to find out. And so we were on the, you know, doing the Today Show. Yeah, because he was a big golf guy, and it was probably about a seven minute hit. And one of the things that I said was, you know, newfound fortune and fame. You know, what are you doing? What's your wife make of all of this? And I said, well, she's over at Nordstrom's across the street buying all the shoes. I mean, she's in the ladies' shoe department, you know, having some fun. Didn't think anything about what I said, right? Well, a week later, we go back to the house. We're back in Austin, or sorry, back in El Paso, and the phone rings back when we had actually home phones. And answered up is, hello? Said, hi, this is so-and-so from Nordstrom's. Okay. How can I help you? I said, did I not pay my bill on time? I'm like, I'm sorry, I've been on the road for a month, and I, you know. No, everything's fine. You know, in fact, you don't even have a balance. But there's something that's very strange that came up, and we just need to check with you. I said, well, how do you mean? She goes, well, you had a balance of, like, your credit limit was like $2,500. I said, yeah, that sounds about right. Back when I had a Nordstrom credit card. She goes, well, it's now been increased to $50,000. And apparently somebody from the Nordstrom's family was watching the Today Show, and unbeknownst to me, the credit limit went right through the roof, and I had a $50,000 credit limit at Nordstrom's.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Just in case.
Just in case.
Buy some khakis or white pants.
White pants.
Who are your best mates in tour?
You know, I didn't have a whole lot of best mates out there. You know, the guy that I used to love the most to play golf with, every possible chance was Pete Lonnard. Pete Lonnard was just a good soul Aussie dude, you know, just different, you know, because back in the day, you know, in the 90s and 2000s and whatnot, all the sports psychologists are out there saying, hey guys, you know, you need to be on your own. You need to be spending time with yourself. You need focusing on this, that, because Tiger was out there just kicking the crap out of everybody. And, you know, it was a mental beatdown. And so all these sports psychologists were saying, listen, don't get too wrapped up in hanging out with other players and this, that. You can do that when you're at home. Because there'd be a lot of guys that lived, you know, in Florida near each other, Dallas, Phoenix, around the country. Hang out with them at home. When you're out here on the road, this is business. This is, you know, professional time. And so there were a lot of guys where you would walk into a player locker room, player lounge, and there'd be 10 guys having breakfast at 10 different tables. I mean, that was the norm.
I heard a story about Steve Stricker once said that he was as close to Tiger Woods as anyone. And he also then said he'd never shared a meal with Tiger Woods. Yeah, so it's kind of sad, isn't it?
That's the reality of the situation. I mean, you know, I think that Tiger back then was just kind of so in his own world and so elusive that that's what he did. You know, I mean, he wasn't there to make friends. He wasn't there to be chummy. He wasn't there to do anything other than compete and, you know, beat us into submission. And so, you know, people always used to come up to, you know, ask about after the scandal with his ex-wife. Oh, come on. You must have known. And my reply was always, listen, if I had known, I'd have blackmailed him and I'd have been flying around on a Challenger for the rest of my life.
Damn right. Yeah.
That's exactly right. I mean, I'm gonna use my information for good for me, right? I mean, nobody knew what was going on with him because, I mean, he was about as elusive as it got. I mean, once he left the golf course, nobody knew where he went. And that was the way it was.
Just check the Waffle House.
Yeah.
You'd have found him there.
No, it's actually IHOP. Let's not take down Waffle House. Yeah. Waffle House is its own, sacred. It's its own sacred environment. Let's not, you know, and I like IHOP, but Waffle House is just like.
Agreed. 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 Yeah.
Okay. Man. So moving on, when did you stop having your card on tour? When was it you kind of felt as if full-time golf was not going to happen anymore?
The end of 2011, I lost full-time status. That comes on the heels of an injury in 2010. But I think I saw kind of the writing on the wall after I had neck surgery in 2010. I think that trying to put the time and effort and energy into it after coming back, what I should have done was just hung up the clubs for a year and just said, listen, I'm not even going to try for a year, because I think at some point, you know, with the fact that, you know, I'd already been out there for about 11 years and accomplished a hell of a lot more than I ever had, but you just kind of get burnt out. You know, I think that there's so many things going on, you know, more mentally than anything else. And that's the one thing that, you know, let me just touch on this real quick here, is that when folks talk about the difficulties mentally that athletes go through, that's very real. It's not, you look and see that these guys are out there playing for millions of dollars, no matter what their sport is, anything like that. But the mental difficulties are real. It is, you don't see it because everybody tries to put their best foot forward and their face on board. And let's face it, who do you see on TV playing well? The leaders, the guys that are winning. I can promise you the guy that just missed the cut early this week is going through some anguish, and it is not easy. So at some point in before 2010, before I got injured, I'd kind of felt like, you know what, I'm not too sure I want to continue doing this, because there was a lot of pain in playing golf where there was no pain as a kid. And I think that I've gotten past all that. Now I love the game again. It's fun, and I suck at it comparatively. Right. And so it's just one of those interesting things where you have to get past the fact that, you know, it is a job. If you're not doing well in something that you love to do, you're going to, you know, you're going to suffer. So I lost interest probably in 2000. I was so happy to get injured. I was happy to have that. I was so happy to have a microdiscectomy happen where I could not move my arm. And I literally was walking around like, you know, I was so happy to have that injury. I just wish that it would have had the strength to tell everybody around me, I'm done for a year.
Yeah.
But I didn't. So that's okay, sure. So in 2012, though, once 2012, the end of 2012 hit, I was really, you know, you've met my wife, Gordon. You know, thankfully, Sarah was very supportive of me pursuing what I do now, which is TV work. And it's worked out brilliantly for me.
Yeah. When did you started working for Sky Sports? 2014, correct?
15. Yeah. 15. I got 2 years of experience in 13 and 14 with the Golf Channel. Then at the end of 2014, I got a call from Sky Sports, and it's been awesome. Awesome ever since then. Yeah. I love what I do. I love the team that I work with, including Cole Turk.
We did mention that in the podcast.
That's another podcast. But you know, I just love the people I work with because it's so much fun where you go to work and everybody's got your back and you know that they have your back and you have their back. And it's a team environment. It's everybody looking out for each other and having fun and doing the right thing and grinding. Everybody's grinding for the entire week. Like this week, the Players Championship, it's going to be a massive, massive grind starting Wednesday. But then by Sunday, when it's hopefully over with, and we don't have to go into Monday because of weather, it's everybody's all hands on deck. Everybody's got his back, and it's a cool space to be in.
Yeah. We've got a lot of UK listeners as well. And anyone that ever texts me or they talk about it, I talk to people back home. They always love your insight because it's very honest. It's not the normal bullshit kind of, you know, golfy, golfy.
The one thing that, again, it's because, you know, I have the support of the other guys that I work with and I'm looking across from them. And, you know, we certainly want to portray, you know, what it's like being a professional golfer and not, you know, we don't want to fluff it up, but we also don't want to beat players down either. You know, like, you know, we talk about Rory McIlroy a lot because he's, you know, for our audience, he's the number one audience in the UK, but he is such an amazing player and he makes 68s look ordinary. You know, more than any other player in the game, it seems like. And yet, you know, he shoots 65 at Bay Hill and then follows it up with an even par and then pair of 76s on the weekend. And it's not that there's no passion there, because if you watch him on Sunday, he broke his wedge over his leg at the back of the green on 12. So he's got the passion. It's just that he's also human like us. And and golf just happens, and he got flustered. He absolutely got flustered, right? And you know, a lot of people are quick to criticize him when he doesn't win, but I tell you what, he puts himself in contention more often than I think than any other player. I mean, it seems like when he tees it up, I have a hard time remembering where he was just kind of going through the motions and well out of contention going into Sunday. But I know what happens, but golf does happen, and I love him because he's honest.
I'll be honest with you as well, Rich. I love seeing emotion in the golf course. I've said it forever. Love seeing players break clubs, throw them, do whatever. Yeah. Don't shout to your caddy like Bubba Watson did.
Yeah.
You know, berate the caddy, etc.
Ted Scott's doing just fine.
You know, but you know, snap the club.
And once again, I try and find the balance in all of this, you know. And I do think that at times Bubba was yelling at Ted, but I also think that he needed to get something out of him instead of throwing a club. But I think Bubba would have been best served breaking a club or throwing a club instead of yelling at someone else about something that just happened, because now it becomes, you're attacking that person, even though Ted never felt like he was attacked. I mean, if you look at Jordan Spieth and his conversations with Michael Breller, he's not ever barking at him. He's just verbalizing because he has to get it out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I promise you there, you know, Trevino was probably the best of the best, you know, verbalizing stuff. And I'm pretty sure he probably had some conversation with Herman that we never heard about. But I mean, I don't think he's ever attacking his caddy. He just needed to get it out and just have, you know, figure out a way to get rid of that angst that this game causes.
There's so many more things I want to talk to you about. We could go on for hours. However, there's a couple of things I want to touch on, right? At what age did distance-wise you start going back the way, if it's going back the way?
It's finally starting to. I think that, funny enough, my swing speed now is faster than it was when I was on tour back in the day. But I probably don't hit it as far. I think it's just more efficient. I'm gonna go off track here, but really funny. So I forget what it was. Like, I'm gonna say it was funny. If I go back to like 02, and I was playing in LA with Azinger the first 2 days, and Azinger had this really crappy Mizuno driver, and I was paired with the first 36 holes, and I just kept hitting it by him. And by him. And at first 18 holes, he was okay. Then after 27 holes, you could tell he was getting really upset that I kept hitting it like 20, 30 by him. And it was an easy 20 or 30 by him, right? And so we get around to number two, which is our 11th hole on Friday. And he's going to step back and crank on one. And he gets up there and just spins the shit out of it and hits it weak right out there. And he's takes his metal spikes and steps on the top of his driver, punctures a hole in it. I mean, it just demolished it, right? He gets done with the round, calls up TaylorMade, finds the guy that fit me named Scott Cuppett, and drives from LA down to San Diego and says, I want to understand why Rich Beam is hitting it 20 to 30 by me. That is like,
That's awesome. That's
and,
awesome.
And to hear him tell the story is even better because he's still pissed off about it, right? You know, I just think that the way that the equipment now is lighter and you can swing it faster without having to worry about the spin, and you can hit up on it, because back in the day you couldn't hit up on it. You kind of had to hit it at a zero angle. Where with Persimmon, you almost had to hit down on it. And then now all of a sudden we have to hit up on it. Now, the more you can hit up on it, now you can, without worrying about the spin. So I think that's why now my club head speed is faster, but it's also like, I mean, the shafts, like I'm using that Korean Autoflex shaft.
Oh yeah.
The Korean hidden technology.
Autoflex.
I'm telling you what, man, I haven't seen any numbers on TrackMan, but I think that I'm interested to see how much I spin it and all that. But from where I am right now, it's so easy to swing. It's a joke. But
caddy for this billionaire. He got the auto flex in his driver. He liked it so much, he got him through all his irons too. He's got auto flex in every club in his bag other than the putter.
Listen, good for him. I guarantee you, it makes him swing it at it easier.
It's amazing. His tempo is better. He's 82 years old and he's crushing.
And he just is. I bet you it renewed his golfing life for another, you know, for as long as he lived, because he does not have to swing it at that fast. And that golf ball just comes firing off there. Good, it's amazing. Him.
Yeah. Oh wow, that's interesting.
$900 a shot.
So, what clubs were you using? When you won 2002? What was the?
I just switched over to TaylorMade. I was with Callaway for the first 3 years of on tour, and then I switched over to TaylorMade. And a lot of it had to do with the guy that worked for him, Scott Cuppett. He was one of the first guys I met at Callaway, and he left. He left Callaway to go work for TaylorMade. So he invited me to, so TaylorMade signed me. But funny enough, I was still using the Callaway golf ball when I won the PGA. I was using the Hex Red. So I stayed with the Callaway golf ball. I loved the Callaway golf ball.
So the TaylorMade irons would have been the racks. Is that right?
The 360s, maybe?
Yeah,
the
rack 360. Yeah.
The 2 millimeter Tom Lehman offset. I think they were the three. I don't think they're the rack. I think they're just the they were like a cavity
before
back.
The rack.
That's before the rack.
Before the rack.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, before the rack. So they had this offset on a 2 millimeter. It was 2MMTL, Tom Lehman. He created them and they were dead sexy. That's back when people used to put offset in their irons, and now you can't find offset into anything other than, you know, massive game improvement irons, which is too bad.
And what kind of putter have you always used?
All of them.
Tinker.
I've never discriminated against any putter. And if you see me putting left-handed, I've been discriminating against left-handed putters for a while now, but it might be time.
Before we finish off, I'd like to hear any good caddy stories.
Ooh.
Oh,
there's got to be a good, like, untold Steve Duplantis story. I mean, rest his soul. God, but no, God,
listen. I next time we do one of these, I will tell you the whole Steve Duplantis collection.
Okay.
I've got a lot of stories, but there was one time. And I don't even know why this pops up, but, you know, I don't want this to portray negative light, but on the player, when he's not even on tour anymore, but there was a player back in the early 2000s, had some pretty good success, never won, but pretty good player. And he had a caddy on his bag who now is Bernard Langer's caddy, Terry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And this player was on, we were playing at the old Kepler Open, and we're on the 10th tee, and we were in contention going on Sunday, but this player had kind of fallen away a little bit. And Terry was just digging in the bag. He was digging the bag for something at the turn, whether it's a snack or something like that. And for whatever reason, this guy had rabbit ears, because obviously it wasn't going his way. And he looks over at Terry and goes, "Terry, if you're not out here to help me, don't hurt me." And I'm kind of thinking to myself, you know what? There's only one guy inside the ropes right now that has your back.
Yeah.
And it ain't me. And it's not my caddy. And it's not the scorer. And it's not the standard bearer. Like, literally, you are going to – that's what I don't get about guys who berate their caddies or this, that. Mm. Like, I have yet to find a single caddy that's ever decided to sabotage their player mid-round. Now, I've seen guys drop the bag because the player is such a jackass. And it's just like, you know what? I fail to see how a caddy has ever said, you know what? I've got plenty of dough. I don't really think that I want this guy to win right now. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to sabotage it.
F him.
Yeah, so it's a great point, because I've said that to people in the past as well, amateurs as well. I say, I'm not paid.
Yeah, I'm not paid. It's not in my interest to give
you bad information.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's just like, you know, it's like the golfers, they watch TV and they think that, oh my gosh, this player is, you know, I mean, you know, he's got to teach his caddy a thing or two. It's like, wait a second. I'll tell you a funny story about, I only got upset at my caddy once, and we were at the Byron Nelson, and I wanted to hit 6 iron. He wanted me to hit 5 iron, and I didn't commit. And I was mad because I wanted to hit a 6 iron. Well, the only person that's ever going to pull the trigger on that club is me. So I got over that pretty quick. But the one, this is probably my second funniest story, is that a few years ago, we went over to Houston to try and qualify for the Houston Open. This is where I'm working. Mm-hmm. We just kind of went over there on a whim, you know, had nothing better to do. So we took off, went over there, had Mexican food for lunch, a couple margaritas. I mean, that's how serious we were taking this Monday qualifier. Like, right, I just wanted to, you know, spend some time with them.
Yeah.
So the second hole, we get up there, and I never carried a yards book, ever.
Never?
Wow.
Never.
Wow. Good man.
No. You trusted your caddy always.
No, listen, I don't. I mean, it's just too confusing. Too confusing. So we get up to the second hole. He paces it off. Get up there. He goes, all right, we got 92 to the hole. I'm like, all right. And greens look a little soft this and that. He goes, so if I, you know, you hit it, you know, and we got to get up on the top shelf. So maybe on a 95-yard shot. He goes, perfect. 95-yard shot, get up on top, whatever. Get up there, hole it out. Right? Hole it out. So
okay. Good number.
Thinking, all righty.
Yeah, man, here woo-hoo. We go.
Where's the margarita car? We just want margaritas, right? We get up there at the green, pull my golf ball on the long corner side of the green. Billy goes, great shot, bro. He goes, hey, listen, how long were you together? I said, oh, 14 years. Yeah, that's what I thought. 14 years. How many times do you think I ever gave you a bad number? I'm like, well, I don't know, maybe once. Because you know what? I kind of pride myself. I don't think I ever gave you a bad number 14 years. Like, okay, I agree with that. Because yeah, you just got a bad number. I'm like, what? Because yeah, I added instead of subtracted. You actually had 70. It's 78, not 92. And I'm like, so I just hold it out
and getting the a wrong 14 number.
Yard difference shot.
Wow.
I go, this round, this someone is going to be what could possibly go wrong?
That's beautiful. That's awesome. That's beautiful. Yeah. That's beautiful. How much do you think, okay, in four rounds, would a caddy help you, do you think?
Oh, I mean, you know, it's funny because I had a different relationship with my caddy, but I think just having him there helped me out every shot. Seriously. I mean, every shot. I mean, he, you know, just having him there just to bounce off an idea or just to kind of feel like, you know, just knowing that I had his support and him being there was enough for me. In saying that, you know, I put a lot of faith and trust in that relationship. That's why I never wanted to switch very often. And then if I ever had a different caddy, I was very untrustworthy. I didn't go into that relationship very easily. Now I do it a hell of a lot easier because, you know, it's not as important, but there were times where, like, if Bill couldn't caddy for me for a certain week, I was miserable. I hated it.
I read on Twitter not long ago that the best caddy you ever had was the nine holes I worked for you out here. Is that something you stand by?
Did you actually work, or did you just use the Bushnell thing?
You ride in the cart? No, yeah.
I was the one drinking beers in the car.
Yeah, that's about right.
Listen, you by far I was the easiest boss you ever had.
close to it. Give us two pieces of information or two pieces of advice for amateur golfers listening right now.
Hit more club. Don't feel like you can take. Don't feel like that pitching wedge goes 135 yards. It doesn't, especially go to Pebble Beach. Jesus Christ.
Bro, you're preaching to the choir here. You're preaching to the choir.
Listen. They just need to listen.
We just lie to people. If it's playing 150, they're like, oh, give me my nine iron. Well, no, it's playing 165. Let's hit your eight iron that really goes 150.
Or seven iron.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Exactly.
So hit more club.
Hit more club. Yeah.
Well, hit more club, and on and around the greens, it's just like play a little bit more break. Try and dive in the hole. Don't take the perfect line. Just ease it on around the hole. Let it fall in dead weight. Don't say, well, I just right edge and firm. No. Amateurs should never hit the ball in firm. No, because when you try to hit it in firm, it goes 6 feet by.
And you'll miss that too.
You're going to miss that too.
Excellent advice. If there's any young people listening that want a career in golf playing, what would be your top piece of advice for them?
I think it would have to be, you know, beat everybody that you're around. First of all, don't just get up there and, you know, think that your game's going to improve over time, which it can, but beat everybody that you play around with there, and then go to get out of your comfort zone and go play on the road someplace. Don't think that, you know, your home club, if you're the best in your home club, then you're the best a lot of places, because a lot of people's games don't travel very well. But, you know, I just think for young kids that want to go do it, make sure and don't, if you want to go play for a living, don't say, I'm going to try and go play. Once you say, I'm going to try, you're done.
Yeah.
Once you say, I'm going to go play, I'm going to go play this, I'm going to go play that, now you have some focus.
All right, Rich, last question for you. Are we going to see much of you out in the Champions Tour in the future?
You're going to see me about 6 times per year, depending on. I have too good of a time working for Sky Sports to ever give this up. I'm not fully exempt on the Champions Tour, unfortunately, so I can't pick and choose. I have to write for some sponsor invites. I am exempt for 3 majors, which is nice.
Nice.
And I like my chances in all 3 of those majors, even though I'm playing against the best of the best. The one thing that I have in my favor is that I get to watch the best players in the world week in and week out. I still learn from them. I still take a lot by watching them and how they pick apart and dissect a golf course and their attitudes about missing greens or making errors, because it's not about how good the good is. It's how do you handle the bad?
Yeah.
Because handling the good is easy.
Yeah.
It's how do you handle the bad? So I look at the best players in the world. I don't take away what they do great. I take away when it fails and how do they bounce back? That's what makes you a better player. So I watch those guys. I do that. So mentally, I feel like I'm as strong as anybody out there. It's just the physical part of it. I still get the heebie-jeebies over a few things, and that's just the reality of it.
That's
golf, baby.
If you play in one of those majors or one of those tournaments this year, give me a call. I'd love to come and carry for you and make some content.
Abso-freaking-lutely, boys. That'd be awesome.
Excellent. Okay, well, listen, Rich, many thanks for joining us
on
the Real Life Carry podcast. It was a pleasure. I look forward to seeing you November latest.
November at the latest. I will absolutely be out there. Can't wait.
We'll do another episode in person. We'll come up with some fun content. And as I say, you know, we're
are you going to caddy for me this year, actually? You're going to bail back to the amateurs?
Yes. No. Let's go for it. I'll go with you.
Yes.
I'll commit to that right now.
Yeah, you heard it.
Michael Hackett. Sorry, mate.
You're out.
Hackett's gone. Yeah, somebody's got to take over for Hackett.
Hackett is he's off. I'm going with the pro.
There you go.
All right. Sounds good.
Many thanks for your time, Rich.
Thanks,
have a
Rich.
Great time Cheers, at the players.
Thanks.
And we look forward to speaking to you soon, okay?
Guys, you're the best. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you.
See you guys.
Bye.